fire off his questions, let's start the discussion.
No, that's great, that they need something like that.
Terry, could you shut the blinds behind the Terry Hart to see Mary? Thank you so much.
Matt?
Yes, I guess my question is, I've often seen in different communities that I've lived in that initiative like Pearl and others, that they have a great benefit in revitalizing, but oftentimes they don't have the lens that allow people of color, whatever indigenous community live there, to be able to stay there as in an affordable way. And so I guess my question would be, what is that strategy going forward that addresses that particular issue? And I don't know if there is a strategy, that may be something that they can talk about.
Well, I can't speak to what's going on in Apalachicola because I'm not involved in the work. But I can tell you in New Orleans, where I'm an affordable housing developer, various strategies have been used. I think one that would be particularly relevant in Apalachicola, particularly at this time, would be a community land trust strategy, where land is purchased and held in a trust, and is maintained, anything built on that land is maintained as permanently affordable housing. So we're doing that now in New Orleans in a neighborhood that's beginning to see rapid property increases. And we are purchasing land, we're developing housing on it, and then we're controlling the sale of that property, not just to the first home buyer, but for every home buyer afterwards. So in a home ownership strategy, that's a great way to keep property affordable in perpetuity. There are also, you know, rental strategies that people use. I'm not as familiar with that, but there are definitely rental programs that are affordable long-term.
So are there strategies that actually, does it change the format of private property ownership, but it has incentive to keep the cultural fabric in place?
If I may make a point, please. Dr. Humphries and I have been talking, along with the folks, about the possibility of getting a group to invest. We start talking about the black folks that are involved in the Hill, because we don't want the property to be sold and then all of a sudden everything in terms of the black folks being involved in that, it's gone. So this is what we want to do. We want to get these people to come in, basically people from Apalachicola, not outside, but people from Apalachicola, to invest in Apalachicola property in terms of building and developing the Hill. Okay, so that means that the Apalachicolans can get together. We've talked to several people involved, most of them black people that are involved, and we're talking about putting it together and organizing it. And Dr. Humphries is the one that's leading this. So I think that all of you know something about him, right? And he has he's really done an excellent job. He did an excellent job with FAMU, in case you didn't know.
Could you identify yourself?
I'm Chauncey Ford.
Thank you.
I grew up in Apalachicola. And I wasn't born here because I was born in Brooklyn, New York, but my dad was born here. And I came down after he went to the service. And unfortunately, he was killed in the service. And I was 12 years old at the time. So when I came down, I came right here to Apalachicola. And I've been in Apalachicola with my family now. I don't know if any of you know Sam Stevens, but he owned a bar that was up on 8th Street that is now belonged to this young lady back here. but that was the bar. And I know you were interested in everything that he had to say about the structure of Apalachicola, but see, I've been here a long time, so I'll be 85 my next birthday. So when he talked about all these things, I knew his grandfather personally. You know, I used to go up and buy meats from him. When we had, they didn't have refrigerators then, you had ice boxes. Mm-hmm. And you had to buy your meat almost every day. So he was the one that sold that. And we had a service station, we had a gas station. Sigma White owned the gas station. And I imagine that the stores here is still underground there. We had grocery stores. George Clark owned a grocery store. Sigma White owned a grocery store. My uncle had a grocery store to go along with his liquor store. Believe it or not, we had a house on every block. On every lot. And it was a vibrant community. Yeah, it really was. And we rarely had to do anything in terms of going downtown to do it, except for banking. Other than that, in the post office, but other than that, everything was done on the hill.
Mr. Ford, don't forget the funeral home and Mr. Bob Simpson.
In terms of pressing club, that's what we used to call it. Everybody in the whole Apalachicola came to Bob Simpson's place to get their clothes cleaned and pressed. Yeah, and it was the only place in town. Johnny Kinlaw had a taxi. A service. You know, can you imagine that bunch of people would have taxis? Yeah, the bus stop was here. The Greyhound bus was coming all the time. We had Shipe's Mill. We had a porky plant that was out, we'd call it Bay. They said, yeah, we had a plant out there. And
Chauncey, if I can, we love the history of Appalachia.
Okay, let me stop.
But these people are going to go home.
I didn't mean to get in. I'm so involved.
Speaking of Chauncey.
I could just pick up on one. I think it was a great question about gentrification and what can be done to sort of keep that tide at bay as best possible. I know there's a lot of expertise up here, but just to throw out a few things. One is that in considering zoning changes right now on a parallel track, you need to be thinking about ways of preserving those in place that are already in place. And I can think of several ways to do that, because once the zoning change happens, smart people are going to start moving. I mean, they've already started moving. Change has already started occurring. So, in Atlanta, where we're from, the Beltline is pretty notorious, and Richard and Ryan can speak a lot about this, but the Greenway, the old railway, that is being sort of a rails-to-trails of a high-end sort, it has displaced many of the, progressively, the African-American families that lived in the area, because the city didn't invest ahead of time. And this may be unfair, Richard, you can let me know, but I think the city didn't lay the groundwork to help those families stay in place in the rentals or in homeownership. So what can be done? So one thing that Ruffin mentioned that's critical is helping people with air property and title issues. So law students at FAMU, if Dr. Humphreys could get with the dean at FAMU, or the dean of the law school at FSU, it's a wonderful way for law students that we teach to learn about title problems. But for those people that don't have wills, to get wills. For those people where it is fractional ownership of 12 cousins who own the property, helping them clear that up, doing a quiet title action to help address those title issues is critical, because no one has control of that land. It is in limbo. And so those people can't protect themselves. And ultimately something bad will happen with that property.
Wasn't that a problem in New Orleans?
Any legacy city, it's going to be a problem. Yeah.
And one addition to that is it, a lot of the groundwork, Georgia, about 2 years ago, passed an air property statute from the state government to try to sort of codify and provide a process to move through and help people figure out who should have the title and how it should work, as well as to protect from overzealous, or sometimes say greedy, developers. And so there's a lot of legwork that's already been done, is what I'm trying to say. You don't have to reinvent the wheel or start your own process. Dr. Humphreys and others can look at what Georgia, does Louisiana have an air property statute? I don't know.
There are only about four states in the total of the U.S. that have that Uniform Air Property Act. Maybe three of them in the air property dense states, but Florida, of all the southern states, we don't have anything.
Don't have anything. Okay.
And standards being modest, she just done a dissertation on air property.
Excellent. Oh, excellent. Well, there you go. There you go.
So, can I, to follow up on, how do you address the zoning, as you just mentioned, to at least make it stagnant or stop it until some of these air property or land ownership issues are addressed? Or is that even going on in the city yet now? Is there any zoning around this issue?
We discussed some of the problems this morning that are preventing development. So there are obstacles in the way of redevelopment now, which may be working in the favor of slower redevelopment of property. But as you were saying, as the changes occur, it will accelerate change as far as redevelopment is concerned. And one other plug for something Ruffin said, a land bank, you know, if we had our basket of wishes here, a land bank would be wonderful as a place to hold property that is vacant, taken because people haven't paid their taxes because it's been dilapidated, there are code liens, they've been foreclosed, et cetera. But to have a public authority that can hold vacant properties, and because they're a public authority, they're able to say, we're going to make decisions about where we want these vacant properties to go, and that a priority in the community is going to be development of moderate income housing, for instance. And so they can put out a request for proposals that can blend with this zoning scheme, but can have values with respect to inclusive housing in the community.
And there should be help somewhere in the state of Florida with a land trust organization that helps to facilitate other organizations. I'm sure that exists. So the starting point is not starting from scratch, but contacting the people that are already advising
you.
If I could add two things. One is that there is an existing land trust organization here. They're not very active right now. But another one is that we feel a lot of people are leaving their homes because of developments like Denton Cove. So if this housing is provided, it drains the neighborhoods. And instead of taking the money that goes into these tax credit places, if the money goes into helping the people stay in their homes, we feel like everything would be better off. And the title issue, I think what Marie was referring to also is that as far as being prepared for a disaster like a hurricane, what happens when a hurricane blows through is that anyone who doesn't have a clear title to their house gets nothing from FEMA. So the people who are organized get help. The people who need it most get nothing. And, you know, that is really critical to address that.
The area I'm from in Rhode Island, South County, probably 10 or 15 years ago, they were developing all the farm area down there. Mm-hmm. Believe it or not, they were commuting from Providence. And so the city council, South County, put a moratorium on selling any land for a year. Now, I don't know if we could get that done here, but maybe we could get a 3-month moratorium or something so we'd have a chance to breathe and come up with, you know, some kind of plan and some help from some other people, because, you know, land is selling right now, you know, the lots are going.
Land is key in all of this, land ownership, and in America, it's one of the hardest things to control, particularly in the Deep South, where you have these property rights states, which in Louisiana, where I, you know, run my nonprofit, means pretty much don't tell me what to do with my land. And so it's, I agree with John wholeheartedly. I mean, it's very important. People are vulnerable if their titles are cloudy, if their property is in a condition that it might be fined and penalties rack up. Land is key. So keeping the land that you already own is one way of controlling it. But then going forward, you know, understanding if property is developed, under what scenarios can that property be developed? Because even if, as this gentleman suggested, a group of locals get together and develop something, in the free market, it can be sold to anyone. So it's not just who's developing it, but what it's being developed for and how the what the restrictions as far as resale are on those properties going forward. You know, we've developed, as John mentioned, you know, 200 homes. We can control the first purchaser of the home, but every purchaser after that, we have no control over. Mm-hmm. And that's why we're looking at the community land trust model now, because the in perpetuity, the next purchaser and the next purchaser and the next purchaser. In Louisiana, it's a very hard sell, particularly in the African American community, where people have been swindled out of property for years and years and years. And for a lot of folks, they looked at it and they said, oh, this sounds like sharecropping, you know? So there's been a lot of discussion in our community to kind of get comfortable with this and sort of understand what a community land trust is. Up north, Creighton and I mean, we were in a co-op together. It's common in New York City, that's, you know, but it's yet another form of ownership. And there was a 15-year resale policy on that, and, you know, we stayed there, but then that evaporated, and that is no longer affordable housing.
I think that you have a really great point, because in North Florida, I can't speak to black people in South Florida, but anything that talks about cooperative is not an easy sell at all. I think something that you just said that I'm brought tears to my eyes that thinking exists is figuring out a way that we validate the problem of air property, and that it's not a quick fix kind of thing, but that at least we can slow down movement to try to work with families to deal with the lack of resources, the family conflict, the title clearing processes that the county has that inhibits them from clearing title. But if we had time to do that, it would bring about major change. And I think then you would see probably more people of color participating in this discussion, because they would then feel like, well, okay, the government is behind us keeping our land.
Yeah.
That means something.
But, you know, it's funny because, I mean, I agree wholeheartedly with you, Sandra, because my family ended up suing each other for property. And it went on for, I mean, it got nasty. I was sort of way down the chain, but I remember my father talking about it. So this issue of not leaving a will and heir property can really get nasty. Having someone to go to, it's to try to interface with your family or your group, try to resolve these issues would be something very helpful.
I mean, to me, it sounded, I smell a Florida Bar Foundation grant to resolve some of the title issues. To me, those are, if families want their title to be organized and resolved, then it's a pretty straightforward process. No. It sounds to me like what we need is a group of people who would be willing to work with the multiple heirs and see if there's a solution that's acceptable to everybody and then get some pro bono work done to get it legally accomplished. But the legal end is...
That is not simple. And the fact that Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, South Carolina, North Carolina, Virginia, those states have done a lot of work. But even with what they have done, it is only tapped the issue of heir property. A lawyer here about 5 years ago told me that she spoke to someone at the Florida Bar Association who said that he doesn't see where something like a uniform heir property title clearing application or process is relevant because he doesn't see heir property being an issue. So I do agree with you that the bar needs to be involved. However, there has to be a strategic strategy to help them understand that that's a problem because heir property for a long time has been something that developers have used to increase their wealth.
Yep.
So there are a lot of layers to the problem. But I think this kind of discussion and these people, you all who are talking, help give voice and can make some movement with the Bar Association and not trying to blow my horn at all. But my whole dissertation has been about breaking down those levels and looking at them to see where all those barriers are. And how do we overcome
it? Tell me who you are. I love hearing you. I don't know you.
We met before. I brought my aunt down to the museum once. But my name is Sandra Harris Thompson. I'm from Tallahassee. I bought a lot and a half here about 4 years ago.
Great.
And celebrated my 50th birthday here. Gonna love that.
You know, I'm an attorney and one of the newbies in town.
Awesome.
Who is helping move good things in town? So it's good to hear the conversation.
Let me throw out something real quick in terms of also Babylon Color. Air property here also is, it's the same, but it's different when you start talking in terms of the acres and acres of land, because pretty much like what Russell said and your grandfather renovated my grandmother's house, you got tons of people on a house on one lot. My family house, my great grandparents, the good news is we were a small family and no one had many children. But just in terms of the process, to give you an example, my great-grandparents died. The house went to my grandmother and her sister. Her sister had no children. They died. My mom's siblings were dead. My grandfather that I actually called Daddy was really my step-grandfather. When he passed, his siblings then became a party to the party.
Oh.
Everybody got along. But all of them on a house, on a lot, had the sign off on it.
Yeah.
Uncle Ben that lived on 7th Street had died, his brother. Uncle Ben's four children, one of whom lives in Orlando, then had to sign off on it. And it took all of them being dead for me to convince my grandmother, my mom, my grandmother, those were a little smart and did quick claim deeds, that we needed to clear this up as the family grew to make sure that there were no problems. My aunt on 12th Street that was single, she did a quick claim deed with life estate. So in terms of even bypassing probate and all of the others, when my mom died, because they had life estate with sole survivorship, my aunt's house then went to me. But my grandparents were educated people, not that that even comes into play, but they figure that the children will have enough sense to figure it out. And they call money to even get through the process with the lawyers. And with Appalachicola and Appalachicola, it was easy to navigate in the 90s. But could you imagine if any one person had not wanted to sign off on that?
That's what happened in my family.
So it's a major issue.
Yep.
I'd like to get back to four shotguns because everybody's touched on it. It's part of, you know, we spent, you know, the better part of a year trying to revitalize those four shotguns on 8th Street that you talked about and put them in the hands of, you know, make them affordable to the community. John, to use them as an example, Carrie worked really hard on them. If they come up all the time, the four shotguns are sitting there waiting to be
loved
and be returned to the community, be affordable housing. What this
has there been any work done on?
Talk about what is going to be our strategy. You know, is it a historical overlay? Is it a land trust? What should we do to get those back into the community as soon as possible before it's too late?
Yeah.
Is financing an issue, Holly, in terms of...
Actually, it's... it's not that much of an issue. We could come up with the money to redevelop them, at least one or two of them. The issue has been zoning, because to get them into the, you know, to make them affordable, you have to divide them. You have to divide the lots in the city that, as John pointed out this morning, why, but that right now the zoning is not friendly to that. So that's what's stopping us, but meanwhile, a developer could come along and buy the property and either raise all
but
the...
But how can they do that? How? I mean, it's a dumb question, but I'm not...
But you have you guys address that?
Who owns them now?
That's what I'm
Private owner.
Yes, there's a private owner who owns four buildings on one lot, and we tried very hard. We think we could come up with the funding and the expertise and the job training, and we had a whole budget proposed, and Carrie Shea from New Orleans was helping us with her expertise. And, you know, John Marshall was advising us, and the city was very supportive until you got to the issue of zoning. It's, I'd rather have other people talk about it because I'm not that eloquent, and we've got a lot of
The first thing that you should do is try to get a contract with that private developer. Is it for a period of time?
John, could you address what happened?
So I don't know as much about the facts. I think that my guess is one lot, four structures improving that one lot. There was an issue previously about whether houses that had not been occupied for a period of time. The city has a policy, which is now no longer a policy, but at that point, that if a vacant home is vacant for a certain period of time, basically you use the ability to use the house in the way for residents in a non, so it was non-compliant, illegal, if you will, under the zoning code, but the city tolerated the existence as a legal non-conforming use. When people stop living there, then you're supposed to amortize that use and get rid of it. So I understand the city has changed its policy, so it would allow, I think, four rental units. But for a developer to use it, it would either be a non-profit developer, we use, you know, Carrie as our example, or a for-profit developer. I think a for-profit developer would not be able to make the numbers pencil out right now for four rental units, is my guess. That day will come. It's probably coming very soon. So I think the market hasn't moved to get those back into commerce as four rentals, because I think the city would allow those properties to be used in their non-conforming state right now as four rental units. As a developer, I think Carrie realized that wouldn't it be great, because there were two, what I love about Carrie's model, everyone, and this goes to the gentrification issue, there were two families renting two of those units, and Carrie said, I can rehab the two vacant ones, I can get the families in the rental units into the rehabbed units, and then so that there's no displacement of families, right? No displacement. You move them into the newly rehabbed units, and then you lease out as affordable rentals the two more recently renovated ones. Mm-hmm. So the lockstep of Carrie's model is great, but adds home ownership, adds eyes in the street to a rental property and helps make sure it's upkeep in the same way that people look after their homes in the neighborhood. And I think that was the beauty of Carrie's model. So for now, I'm not sure there's an immediate solution to bringing home ownership to those units. I think they could be used as rentals, but I don't know that the economics works to have them rehabbed unless there's a lot of subsidy. If a foundation steps forward or someone steps forward with cash, there's a way to do it.
Well, I can say as a nonprofit, we think we could possibly fund at least some of the project. But we don't want to be in the rental business. So we would like to get them in the hands of owner, you know, some sort of ownership. And we, you know, by getting all this press and this attention, we could possibly do that now. But we can't, because you would have to divide them to
but get I think
them affordable.
The, you know, there's the immediate economic, social issues that are very, legal issues that are very real. But I think the bigger conversation and the impediment to doing something there is the development code that is in the process of eliminating diversity. It's in the zoning code that's limiting. So it needs to be switched. The conversation really needs to be switched to say, how can diversity be not just preserved, but increased over time? And the way to do that is what a few conversations. It seems to be that the idea of a floating district as a short-term solution is not a long-term solution. It only deals with a specific problem or two. Go ahead and get that done. But the other part of it is the historic district overlay that needs to be done, because as I was describing earlier, and it's very clear, this city has, in the historic district, has very different parts. Hmm. And the idea of writing regulations for one part that applies to everywhere makes no sense. So there's downtown, there's the highway, there's the north side and the south side, and the regulations need to be written relative to the conditions in those places. Now, to do that, John said it would cost a huge amount of money to hire a consulting firm to do that. That's absolutely true. But you really don't need that. It's not, because to do a complicated code simply increases the likelihood of more gentrification. And what is more useful is something that is written as tightly as possible as of right. So it doesn't drive architects like me crazy. So you come in and you don't know what to do, and you're moving around, and then nothing good gets done until somebody comes in and is willing to go through that battle and then does something that's awful. So it's something that's very simple regulations to deal with the specific problems, most of them, not most, a lot of which has to do with subdivision. How land is subdivided in a way that keeps, like in the Savannah example I was talking about, you got to keep small houses and you got to allow big houses and you got to have in-between houses. That doesn't do everything you want to do and needs to be done, but it does, like the mayor of Savannah said, it maintains diversity.
Right.
Different people are living side by side. And at some point you say some of the other problems are so difficult that you dig at them as well as you can, but at least you have a neighborhood that is diverse and has diverse people in it. They might not be different colors, they might not be from different class backgrounds, but at least they're a little bit different.
She had a question.
I was just going to say that I think we're moving somewhat in that direction. The zoning regulations were recently changed so that if you are a historic structure and you don't conform as to density, you are now conforming.
Yep. Yep.
So that was the big step. So to take the shotguns as an example, that they don't conform as to density, and now they do. So in theory, they can be sold, they can be mortgaged and financed. The remaining issue is the unwillingness. No, they are.
Sorry. Don't say those who are they're not historic.
The not historic homes, it was a much more limited protection for nonconformity. And there, I think the thinking is that if you are not a historic home, which is pretty liberally defined, then as long as the home is maintained, then you can repair it. It's conformed. But if you abandon it, then it's gone.
Yeah.
But the greater issue with shotguns is that those four shotguns are actually on about 1 3/4 lots. And if you wanted to divide them into two, you would end up with two non-conforming lots. And that issue remains on the table.
Yeah.
If we put our minds to it, we can find a way around the land issue that would allow the houses to be restored and have the land be held in some kind of LLC or common park, like a co-op.
So you were exactly right. I am on the Board of Adjustments, and it was a very difficult decision to make, but it was clearly the only decision we had to make because we can't rewrite the code.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, you can't rewrite the code based on a given situation that's coming, but the code can be redone. And the non-conforming issue is something that, I mean, that was the problem in Savannah.
And the key
to that is to change the idea of what non-conforming is. And a non-conforming lot, if it's backed out of setbacks, side yards, front yards, then it's a problem. So assuming a particular kind of house rather than assuming a lot, and the lots have historical evidence behind them. Now, whether the lots in the four houses could be dealt with, I don't know. I think they can. But the point in the code should be writing the historic district overlay that overrides any underlying regulations or those that the city decides. I've been involved in writing that kind of regulation that then supersedes what's underneath it. And it can supersede subdivision regulations.
Awesome.
As long as the criteria is really clear. And then the ad hoc problem of non-conforming lots disappears because it's historically based and situationally based to preserve history rather than some abstract idea of what the problem is.
And I totally agree with you because that is what they do in Leon County. Our FHE 219 process for air parking owners is in fact a administrative changing of property into subdivision. Say if the code is you can only have one house per 10 or you can only have one house per 3, that FHP 219 says, okay, if you're air property owners, you can, it's like a grandfather, you can change it into lots, you can do whatever you want to do as long as you're air. Now what you're saying, which I thought was really revolutionary, although it's new to you, a whole paradigm shift, is that we move away from a mechanistic understanding of zoning to understanding that it's a, that history is about culture and it's about experiences. So therefore, you write the codes for that particular area to address what those particular needs are. Now, where the FHP 19 falls short in Leon County is that the cost to do it is so cumbersome that people end up still not doing it. So therefore, in Apalachicola, so you do decide to write codes that are specific for a cultural experience, a cultural area, that it is made so that the people it's designed to help can actually successfully navigate it, as opposed to not. So that's what we are dealing with in Leon County. And
it's two different things that are woven together like
exactly,
that.
Exactly, right? Yes.
And there's no magic in that. What all I'm saying is that there's two issues that need to be dealt with. One is a set of regulations that deals historically and accurately with the history of the place,
yes,
and its cultural characteristics. Now, that needs to be done. And it can be done with an overlay district, and it's legal. You can essentially do anything.
Pretty much.
You can do almost anything.
As long as
with
it's
an overlay that supersedes what's underneath it. The other part of that that has to do with who's able to buy and how you protect increases in property values, that's another issue that's really equally important. But I think it's important not to get the two mixed up and need to figure out how to make progress on both of them. I don't know much about the other one. I know about the other one. I think that's part of the difficulty is that some people know about one thing and one thing, right, and it gets mixed right up together.
Right. This young lady's had her hand up for a long time.
I'm fascinated with this floating district that you threw out there. And what I heard you say is the district, and I think what you're meaning is as far as quote codes, is like the south side of town would be a district with their codes, and then the hill would be a district with their codes, and the highway is a district with its codes, and the downtown is a district. Is that what you meant?
Yeah.
That is exactly what you
meant. That's not a floating, that's an overlay.
That's an overlay.
It's an overlay. So what was a floating? You said floating.
So a floating zone, and I agree with Richard and Ryan and Ruffin. I think that there's some consensus up here that overlay is a better way to go, because a floating zone is a tool. It's a possible tool we threw out this morning because it's there. It gives flexibility to, if we will, harsh zoning rules, like Carrie was just describing. Right. Where they, you know, we have a lot size requirement that is not bendable.
Right.
The floating zone requires enacting one ordinance for the entire town that creates the zone, but it floats above the city, right? And so you, as a property owner, say you wanted to be included in that floating zone, right? Okay. So you'd point to the ordinance with your application and say, I understand that there's this floating zone for my shotgun home, and I'm gonna apply to have the special provisions in the floating zone that would, for instance, give you relief from the strict dimensional requirements of the code, the strict requirements about lot size, because we would have written that floating zone ordinance to give you relief from those strict requirements. And then either carry your board or the Board of Adjustment, an inferior board, would say, we'll review the application. And if they determine that you met the criteria in the ordinance, the floating zone ordinance, they would then give your lot a zoning designation that was the designation in that floating zone. Let's call it the Millworker Cottage Heritage zoning designation. Okay. And that would be with your lot forever. That would become your zoning designation for those lots. Yeah, that's how the floating zone would
work. Thank you so much.
But only your lot. That's the thing. It's almost like you have the ray of sunshine going up and darkness everywhere else, right?
And that's all I care
so
about.
So overlay gives sort of everybody within a region, like as of right within the district, as of right, the option.
Okay.
And the floating zone is an opt-in kind of. There's an application you have to go through, and so I think the overlay sounds like a better tool. From my perspective, but floating ones could have, be used
might
as well.
Might be faster.
Yeah, might be faster.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Thanks, Gary. Peter can have to say about shotguns. I've been thinking about this A Street project now for years about. And I've had some experience with a simple condominium agreement where the place I lived before, we had essentially, we bought the land from the person, and all these houses were too close together to conform to the city ordinance. So we formed a simple condominium agreement. We hired an attorney and an architect. We measured halfway between each house, and the architect just described the house on a piece of paper. We went down to the town fathers, and they granted us a condominium agreement. We owned the area under our homes, halfway to the next home. We could transfer deeds. We could do all that. And it was said and done, and it was done in a week. So I'm wondering, in this A Street project, what's to prevent us from just having a simple condominium agreement floated down on this one?
So what Peter mentioned, you can actually, my understanding, and Carrie and others can correct me, and maybe like Fred too, there is a provision in the code that would allow to do exactly this. It's called there's a cluster development provision. Not my favorite provision in the code, but it basically would allow for common ownership of the land in between the four homes. You have to come out with an ownership agreement, basically, to maintain that common space, which is a little cumbersome,
right.
And if you have one slacker, it can throw the whole apple cart up. But there's a cluster development provision that would currently work for those four homes. It could be rezoned cluster. I don't know that there's anything else in town that's zoned cluster. But it would accomplish that, Peter, and it could work. You're absolutely right.
Okay, and what if under those conditions there was no common space that you owned from the alley to the street and halfway to the next house? No common space to maintain. No condominium fees. Just an agreement that you sign into this condominium agreement.
Right. So I think that there has to be an agreement with respect to how that... The way the cluster zone provision that I read recently works is that the units are your unit, Peter, my dad's unit, Fred's unit, Carrie's unit. You got four, but that you share that open space because it's more of an open space zoning provision than anything else, and you share it. So you would, just like you said, you'd have to have a written agreement among your four owners about how to administer the open space. That's how I understand it from a quick read.
And the open space has to be common.
Common.
Yeah. So it's not.
What if there is no open space that's held in common?
Yeah, but there's common and there's limited common.
Yeah.
Right? So the yard space could actually be limited
Peter,
common.
Isn't that land that you and your neighbor own? That is the common.
Yeah. No, it's your individual ownership. In other words, if I have a home and I own halfway to my neighbor.
Right.
I own that.
Yes.
So the only, in this agreement that I was involved in, the only common space was this little road that ran in front of it.
Yeah.
And some waterfront in the back, but it just happened to be that way. But what I'm saying in this instance, there's an alley behind the house, there's a public street in front, both public rights of way. The city can scribe out their ownership. And what if the area in between where these four houses are, with that is surveyed, there are four distinct lots. What if we surveyed that out halfway between each house, where there was no common ownership at all, just went from city owned, to my neighbor, to this neighbor? Why couldn't we have an agreement like that?
So I think that's a, that's effectively a subdivision, right? For
yeah.
I think it's effectively becomes a subdivision that way.
No,
a re-subdivision. Right, that's different. That's different than the cluster. Yeah. So in the cluster, anything outside your window or when you stepped off your porch, that would become the common area.
Okay.
So
then it would work.
Yeah, but then it would work just like you talked about. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
So as a condominium.
It's not controlled by Florida condominium law. So those of you who are zoning geeks like we are, there's something called a plan unit development or a PD development. And this is, I consider it a little bit of a cruder version of that, where it's site plan controlled. And so it's controlled as to where the units are currently. So that you have individual ownership of the units, you know, for you and you and you, but that the space, it's really created for open space zoning, but like conserve open spaces if you wanted to see wild animals or flora, you know, flora and fauna. It's not so much thought of for like an affordable housing mechanism, but technically it could be used in the way that Peter's describing.
And I'll just say, and these are, you know, such great suggestions. I've been doing affordable housing for 30 plus years, and it is very, very difficult for, my experience has been, it is very difficult for low-income families living in housing where the margins are very, very, very tight to self-manage. I've been involved in that. We called it self-mismanagement. We could mismanage that building better than anybody could. And it's very, very, very difficult. And now you're even finding with tax credit developers, they don't even want to do deals less than 35 units because once you get into real estate management, there must be management fees and someone responsible for the management. The self-management thing is very, very difficult, and I wouldn't recommend it to, you know, to anyone, quite honestly. Hate to be such a
downer. But your model was, what you brought to us was one owner, you know, divided, one owner, one renter, and so that created all kinds of problems for us, because where was the hardship? And now the code has been changed and it makes it easier, that answer to that question, but then there's no clear line. This person over here wasn't going to get exactly the same amount of land as this person over here. So I don't know. So this cluster thing with your model would not work at all. You know, with two separate owners.
I mean, you can make this stuff work on paper. It's just in reality. We were trying to prevent the displacement of two very low-income families that are living in terribly substandard housing because they have no other choices. And so we were trying to create an opportunity for them to elevate their living standard without being displaced, but moving into place in on-site. But again, you know, we did it on paper too, and it's, yeah.
You know, I wanted, if I could put Ryan on the spot, there's, Ruffin, you had great, I loved your presentation because it talked about stories of properties on the hill that, you know, as I drive up the streets, wherever we are in town, I don't know all the stories, but the stories are what, now that's changed my whole view of this house and that block. And there are ways of memorializing those sort of stories in terms of software that is out and available. And there's such community buy-in here, and I think part of preserving people's ownership of space, but also the memory of space, which is part of respecting people's stories, is important. And Ryan knows a little bit about this. Can I put you on the spot about it?
Yeah, you already have.
I already have, yeah.
many of you have probably heard about crowdsourcing, which is essentially, you know, getting people that don't have to do it to do something. And let me give you an example. There's lots of places in the world, particularly, let me take Finland. The Finnish National Library just puts out, we need people to catalog books or to actually digitize archives or to write down or to read through, transcribe archives. And they'll just get people who will do it 20 minutes a day, 50 minutes a day. And what they've done is create a collective memory of the Finnish National Library and people who used it, et cetera, et cetera. And as I was hearing the stories, which are the most powerful part of this community, that I would urge you to do something with crowdsourcing, and that is get residents, whether they're new, young, old, how long they've been here, to actually share their stories, create an online website where you can have pictures, you can overlay them with maps, because one, that also helps in creating any sort of historic designation overlay that you want to eventually create, but more importantly, it galvanizes community. I think, and maybe you've already done this.
I would like Pete Olson to talk about, we've put together an interactive map that we link to our website for that very purpose.
For that very exact reason, because we don't want to lose this.
You don't want to lose it.
We're asking the community to be a part of that, to bring those stories forward. And,
fantastic.
You know, I saw stuff that Ruffin had up on the screen that I never seen before. I'm going to hit him up for something. Yeah.
We have a
map with locations and all that. So.
Yeah, if anybody has a story about their house, come just give it to us and we'll get it on the map. You know, south side, north side, anywhere. As long as it's Apalachicola, we can, our software can support every lot in the historic system.
And then you make a public
accessible.
Because if history doesn't
change. Minority communities, the rural community, a lot of things that happen also when we have gatherings, people don't always gather. So what we may have to also do, and I say we since I'm from here, is go to them.
That's right.
They don't come to you. Yeah. And to show the fact that we value that voice.
Yes.
We have to go to where the voice is. It goes back to the 30s and 40s and thinking out tomorrow where you went to the community, you went to the people, and in that way,
and I think that's great. And one model I've seen work very well is actually partnering with local schools, where you have the high schools, middle schools, and you have them. Well, one, you have them detail their own history, but one, you also then they go out to a part of the community and they sit down with people, and they know how to use technology better than any of us.
Yeah.
And they're the ones that really, because also you want that transference of story.
Yeah.
Right, and I found that to be in many places very successful if you can not just partner with the people in the room, but get the schools involved and the younger people.